via Doom or Viaduct Vacation. Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Either way, trips through downtown Seattle are about to look very different. Tonight, starting at midnight, the Highway 99 viaduct closes between the Battery Street Tunnel all the way down to Spokane Street, and it'll stay shut down for about 2 weeks. Now, some people are calling this closure Via Doom, but not the Downtown Seattle Association.
Tom, you know the saying, when life hands you lemon, you make lemonade?
I certainly do.
Well, when they hand me lemon, I make Trot Almondine.
Me too.
Making Trot Almondine out of lemons, those are chefs Thierry Rotureau and Tom Douglas, who both own restaurants in downtown Seattle. They're starring in a video campaign from the Downtown Seattle Association inviting you to hang out downtown instead of trying to get through the traffic. They're calling it the Viaduct Vacation. I asked James Cito with the DSA, how exactly is this like a vacation?
Well, this closure does allow people to shift their commuting time, right? So if you're going to move your commuting time to staying downtown a little bit later, then why not take that extra time and enjoy yourself in downtown Seattle? We think there are a lot of options for you, and hopefully this campaign will illustrate that.
What are those options for spending rush hour?
Well, take your rush hour and go cash-free. There's a lot of free stuff you can do in Westlake Park that requires absolutely zero financial transaction. Go play ping pong, foosball, chess. There's a papa shot there. There's a reading room. If you're looking for a little pre-dinner snack, there's food trucks there. And beyond that, think about all of the restaurants and the shops that are in downtown that are sort of in that area that's going to be a little blocked up by traffic jams, and not to mention all the cultural attractions, the museums, and the theaters. There's just so much to do. So now that you've got discretionary time, go ahead and take advantage of it.
James, instead of staying downtown, some people might respond to this viaduct closure by staying away from downtown. Are your business owners worried about lost business?
Well, here's the thing. If you think back to the closure of 2011, there was a forecast for a Via Doom type situation, and that downtown would be totally locked up and there'd be gridlock everywhere. And I think if you look back to 5 years ago, the initial days following the closure, it was pretty quiet in downtown. You could navigate the area pretty easily here. So I would hope that because the word has been spread very early about this closure and people know what to expect and there's some experience there, that people won't freak out about this. I think hopefully now Seattleites know how to deal with this.
What happens when I'm tired of or can no longer afford eating in food trucks instead of at home and I'm terrible at foosball? Not that I am, because I'm actually quite good at foosball.
No, I've heard you're terrific at foosball.
Mm-hmm.
There are just a multitude of options for you to enjoy in downtown. And I think that, you know, one of the things about living in Seattle is I think that if you've lived here long enough, you forget that you can actually be a tourist in this city and have a really good time. And this closure may give people the opportunity to do just that. Be a tourist again in a city that draws tourists by the millions.
James, some people, maybe it's exaggerated, but some people are talking via doom here and really gritting their teeth. You
yeah.
seem really calm and sunny about all this. How do you do it?
Because I do view this as an opportunity. And some people can look at something that they cannot control, like the closure of a viaduct, and they can get stressed out about it and they can fret, or they can realize that, you know what, this closure is going to happen with or without my input. So why not do something that's going to maybe fill my time with a little bit more enjoyable experience?
James Cito with the Downtown Seattle Association. So are you planning to use the viaduct closure as a reason to do something else? Do you have a traffic coping mechanism that you can share with the rest of us? Let us know on Twitter at #ViaductVacation. Or if you're feeling gloomy about it, you can write under the hashtag Via Doom. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. The Seattle Mariners are not losing. They're half a game above 500, but that's a change for them. And it comes along with a bigger change, a sale. Nintendo of America is selling its majority stake in the Mariners to a local ownership group, and Howard Lincoln is stepping down as chairman and CEO. Seattle Times reporter Jeff Baker told me why Nintendo wanted to sell its stake in the Mariners.
Nintendo's been having its share of financial struggles in recent years. The video game industry is not as popular on their side as it used to be. And at the same time, the value of baseball teams has shot up over the last 5 years because of regional sports television and national television deals. And so Nintendo took a look at this thing and they said, how can we help our bottom line? What assets do we have that are actually worth a lot of money? And you take a look at the Seattle Mariners, they're worth about twice as much as they were 5 years ago. And so if Nintendo was a little hesitant to sell 5 years ago, now they're looking at their bottom line, which is a little shaky, and they're saying, how can we help it? Sell the Mariners. That's how you help it. And they walked away with a big chunk of change.
As part of this deal, the longtime CEO, Chairman Howard Lincoln, is leaving. On social media, fans seem delighted by that. Why is that?
Well, I think Howard Lincoln bore the brunt of a lot of fan frustration over the fact that a Japanese absentee owner owned the team, Hiroshi Yamauchi, who was the patriarch of Nintendo Corporation. He never actually saw them play live. He didn't even see them play when he was still alive, and they went to Japan in 2012. And there was a real sense, and that whole period of Lincoln's reign really corresponded with a downturn in the team's on-field fortunes. They haven't made the playoffs since 2001. So you combine those two things, and I think Howard Lincoln just became the symbol of fan frustration, the fact that he's sort of acted like the de facto owner. He pretty much was the de facto owner. He had all that power because there were no Japanese people who were really interested in running the team on a day-to-day basis, even though they owned it. And so he bore the brunt of the frustration.
So we can't predict a winner. That's why they play the game. But what do you think this sale is going to mean for the fortunes on the field of the Seattle Mariners?
I think they're going to do better, quite frankly, because I think this ownership group's been sitting in the background. It's the same guys that have been minority owners for years. They've been sitting in the background, listening to their neighbors complain about the baseball team. They listen to the radio. They're here in the community. And now that they're front and center, they're done listening to that. So I think they're going to do what it takes to win, and I think that's going to involve spending a little more money than they're spending now. They're going to get themselves into the top tier of spenders, I would assume. That's the biggest thing any ownership can do is spend money and give their general manager and their manager a margin for error in case they don't turn out to be geniuses and make every move brilliantly on the field. Even Billy Bean of the Oakland A's, who's had movies made about him, even he isn't right with every decision. So what these guys can do is spend their way around some mistakes and not give their general manager zero margin for error every time he has to go shopping for free agents every winter. Spend a little bit more money. They're now a top eight team. Money-wise, they're spending about number 12 in baseball. They got to get into the top tier. Give them a margin for error.
But is it really true that whoever spends more is the best team?
No, it's not automatic. Nothing's guaranteed in life. But it is true that if you spend more money in baseball, you up your chances of making the postseason. I mean, that's been statistically proven over even in recent times when it's become easier for teams to win and make the playoffs without spending money. You still up your chances if you spend the money. And the Mariners, basically have done everything you can do to try to make the playoffs over the last 15 years, except spend more money. I mean, they're spending more technically this year than last year, but they're only spending the 12th most in baseball. Last year, they were spending the 11th most in baseball because so many teams are spending more money now because of TV that the salary inflation is huge. So that's the one thing that they can try to do. It's not a guarantee. You still have to spend the money wisely, but there are a lot of teams in baseball now hiring big front office staff of statistical analysts and spending their money on those. And so the rich teams now are getting smarter with their stats keeping. So, being smart's not enough anymore to get to the playoffs. You have to be smart and you have to spend.
What do you think this means to people who are not diehard fans who, really care about whether the Mariners win 15 more games a season, but to the community at large?
This is a community that's waited for a long time to see the Mariners come back and be popular. It's a very patient sports community. The bar is set really, really low here as far as success. I don't think it'll take that much to get them back into the Mariners and give them something to talk about 162 nights a year. There's no winter sports here. So, you need something to talk about in the time when a team is playing. If you have a baseball team doing poorly, it really, really impacts most of your sporting year as a fan.
Seattle Times investigative reporter Jeff Baker. Again, the news is that Nintendo of America is selling its majority stake in the Mariners to a local ownership group. The new Mariners CEO, John Stanton, says his goal is to win the World Series. The Mariners are one of two teams that have never even made it. to the World Series. This is The Record. We asked you how you will cope with the two-week viaduct closure. David Minert tweets, legal weed, hashtag viaduct stress reliever. We assume that means after he's arrived safely at his destination. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. The premier high school football team in Washington, the Bellevue Wolverines, has been in the spotlight after an investigation found the team has been flouting recruiting rules. But there's a bigger question at play here. Why do American high schools put such a big emphasis on sports programs in the first place? Journalist Amanda Ripley writes about education. She says the U.S. is the only country that puts such an emphasis on sports in school, and that sends the wrong message.
Increasingly, as the world and the economy has changed, kids need to be able to do critical thinking and math, reading and science at a higher level than they ever did before in order to have a decent job and a good life. So when you send a message to kids, intentionally or not, that the most exciting, important thing they do is on a football field or basketball court, that eventually they find out that's not true. They eventually find out that for the vast majority of kids, it will not pay for their college tuition. It will not get them a job. And so there's kind of a disconnect between the messages we send to kids and the reality of the world today. And you don't want them to find that out when they're 22. You know, you want them to find out how important math will be to their lives when they're like 12, you know, not 22.
So you'd like to get rid of sports in school or just change the messaging so we act just as excited about the academics as we do on game day when soccer players are wearing their pajamas?
I think we should dial it back. I don't think we should get rid of sports altogether. I don't think that's realistic. I think kids would hate it. But I think we should dial it back, put it in line in the actual relevance it will have in kids' lives so that the things we say to kids about what matters actually line up with the way their days and lives look. So the first step is to really take a cold, hard look at the messages we send to kids. You know, if you're able to miss math class to go play a volleyball game, then that sends a message. If your science teacher leaves to go coach the basketball game during the day, that sends a message. All of these things add up. They distract kids. They distract teachers. Principals in the United States spend two-thirds of their days sometimes dealing with issues related to athletics. That is not something that principals in other countries do. It is hard enough to teach and to run a school at a high level. So this kind of constant distraction is something we should first take account of, be aware of, and then consider whether it actually makes sense.
What evidence do you have that sports distraction actually hurts academics?
Well, you know, there's not been a lot of research on it, but the research we do have is pretty intriguing. A couple of things that come to mind. The first one is there was a big study of what happened to kids' grades as football teams did better and worse. And what they found is that for the students, especially the male students at the university, their grades did significantly worse, even the ones who weren't playing football, as the football team did better. So as the football team won more games, they slacked off on academics. So that's one data point. Another one, I spent some time at a small town in Texas that had actually suspended sports for a year because it was in real trouble financially and academically, and they decided that they had to just reboot everything. And so they stopped football and all their other major sports, and it was a real shock to the system. As you can imagine, the kids hated it. But what they noticed is that fall without football, 80% of the students passed their classes compared with 50% the previous fall. And, you know, they had made other changes too, so it's hard to say if that was a direct result of sports going away, but anecdotally, the students did say they had a lot more time to focus on homework. The place seemed much more academically centered than it did when football was part of life.
I would have thought maybe school sports and the spirit days and all that stuff fosters a kind of togetherness at school and some levity, that it's not so super serious, that maybe it makes school less of a drag for people, whether you play or not.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I mean, this is the complexity of it, right? Like, I think you're right. There are real positives to that. But I think it's about order of importance, right? Like, everybody has a fixed amount of time and attention and money. And so it's about keeping it always secondary. And one example of that would be some schools have started to do things like only join athletic leagues that compete within the county, so they don't have to fly kids or transport kids out of state. There's some common sense things that schools can do, or they have rules like you can never miss class for an athletic event. So I think as we demand more and more of schools and of kids and of principals and teachers, we just ought to take a look at what is reasonable and what lines up with the lives kids are likely to have.
Let's talk about money, Amanda. We have money troubles here in Washington State, struggling to fund education properly, and we've got issues with teacher pay and training. So how would downplaying the influence of sports affect the financing of education?
What you find typically is that high schools are spending 2 to 3 or even 4 times per football player than they are spending per math student. So this is an important thing to just know, first of all, right? And football in particular tends to be the most expensive sport. And again, it doesn't mean you shouldn't do it. It doesn't mean that you should get rid of all sports in one fell swoop, but you should at least know what the trade-off is. In the case of Fremont, Texas, a small town that canceled sports for a year, they found they saved about $150,000 when they suspended sports, so they could use that money to for 1 year to hire a teacher, which they needed desperately. So it's important to at least know what you're spending and then decide if it lines up with what kind of place you want to be.
Okay, so Amanda, let's say a high school, a community, they love their sports, but they can see your points that there are downsides the way it's happening. What's your advice? Where do we start?
If you want to right-size sports as a community, the first place to start is by asking students how to do it, including athletes. So you have to involve them in this conversation and seriously listen to what they have to say, or else they're going to feel robbed of what has become an entitlement for American kids. Like, they really, truly believe, understandably, that playing football under the lights on Friday nights is like a God-given human right, right? And so you cannot take it away without their input. So you have to sit them down and talk to them and say, look, we want to put this in line with reality. Like, you're facing a very competitive job market. You're facing a very different world than we faced when we were your age. How can we make sure that sports aren't usurping academics? What are the ways that we can do that? And really let the students lead that conversation and listen to their ideas, because ultimately they're the ones who are going to be most affected either way. You know, whether we dial back sports or not, I can't tell you how many 25-year-olds I have met who said they wished they knew then what they know now about what the job market and college actually value compared to what they learned in high school.
Journalist Amanda Ripley wrote in The Atlantic about what happens when American high schools prioritize sports over academics. Her piece is called The Case Against High School Sports, and we're tweeting out a link to it right now at KUOW. At KUOW's The Record, I'm Bill Radke. Back in September, most political commentators were writing off Donald Trump as a joke. They said he'd never be a serious contender for the Republican nomination. Christopher Parker knew they were wrong. He's a political science professor at the University of Washington. Not only did Parker predict Trump's rise, he told me it's a good thing for America. It's a teachable moment.
The bigotry with which he speaks, you know, has been part of American political discourse for a very long time. The only difference now is that, you know, back in the 60s and 50s, but really in the 60s, because that's when, quote unquote, old fashioned racism was going out of style, because it became no longer fashionable to speak of black folks in inferior terms, like, we don't want to live next door to them. Black people are really not that smart. I wouldn't want my daughter to marry a black person, right? So that went out of favor in the 1960s and the 1970s. And so what happens is a new form of racism emerged, in which you had anti-black affect. That is to say, they just didn't like black people, married to this perception that black people were violating cherished American values, such as a Protestant work ethic. So the only difference between then and now is that Trump is not using racially coded language. He's very, very upfront and very, very frank about his bigotries.
Which Trump comments are you thinking of right now?
Well, the comments, the first ones that, you know, quote unquote, illegal immigrants are, many of whom are rapists and criminals. And then the anti-Muslim remarks. And then, you know, even more recently saying that Hillary was playing the woman card, right? And then the various attacks on Megyn Kelly and making reference to Carly Fiorina's look. So he's been saying these things for a long time.
And that's good for America. How?
It's good for America because it brings all these bigotries and biases to the surface. This, I think, is what we would call a teachable moment, because these bigotries and biases have been around since the founding of the Republic. And with the exception of the 1950s and 1960s and early 70s, you know, these things were not spoken with, referred to in coded language. But because of the emerging political correctness in the 50s, 60s and 70s, coded language was used. But now we're back to this return during which we don't have to use, or he doesn't feel like we have to use coded language anymore.
So it's a teachable moment. What you look around and what makes you think that we're teaching anything? How do you know we're having a productive conversation? Or are you just hoping for it?
Well, but just think about what's happening in the Republican Party right now. You have a lot of the Republican Party leadership that are just revolted by Trump's language, you know, and his, you know, and the bile that he spews. And I mean, if you look at, you know, you only have like 30% of the Republican Party, 30-35% that support Trump. Where are the rest of them? Well, they don't like it, right? And these are people who are conservatives, right? So, you know, they have, you know, they don't believe in rapid social change per se, but they do believe, these establishment conservatives, if you will, you know, they believe in preserving what is good about America, right? The institutions that work in America, the values on which these institutions rest. And these are not coextensive with what Trump is saying, right? Freedom, equality, egalitarianism. This is not consistent with what Trump has been saying about women and minorities and the lesbian and gay community, with the exception of the whole bathroom issue, which I find quite fascinating.
Okay, so you want a teachable moment coming out of the Trump candidacy. What is key to making that happen? How do you want people to respond? Because there's different ways to respond to Donald Trump. Some people are posting Facebook messages about what a clown he is. You know that, right? There's, how do you want people to respond to the Trump candidacy to turn it into something you think is positive?
Well, to further interrogate, as people are doing on the left, to further interrogate his message, right? I mean, so don't get me wrong. There are some things that people on the left, progressives, agree with in terms of policy, to the extent that one can call a coherent policy proposal from what he said, right? Healthcare reform, right? He doesn't really want to mess with that, right? So that's one. That's just one example. But beyond that, it's the way that he's conveying some of these things. So what I would like to see is, I mean, there's nothing we can do in the way of policy. The only thing we can do right now is just to make sure this guy doesn't become president, because if he becomes president, it is going to be an unmitigated disaster. And it's going to be an unmitigated disaster because the president of the United States of America holds immense symbolic import for the citizens. The president is the commander in chief. The president is the chief law enforcement officer. The president is the head of government. The president is the face of the country abroad.
Okay, so the Trump candidacy has exposed a lot of economic frustration, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, okay, expose. Now what? What do you want to come out of that candidacy, that exposure?
Well, what I would like is for there to be, beyond this, a more sustained discussion over intolerance and bigotry, you know, for, you know, people, for, let me just call it what it's, for straight white men to recognize that, you know, this country belongs to more than them, right? This country belongs to all of us who consider ourselves Americans, and to be, and to have a really substantive discourse, and for them to understand, like, some of the things that we, and I'm a black man, that we go through on the day to day, and for them to be more sympathetic, and beyond that, for them to support policies that try to mitigate the harm that's been done to people from marginalized groups, women, minorities, the undocumented, and people in the LGBT community. Just to be more sensitive to these, because if they're more sensitive, I would like to think that they'd be more likely to support policies to mitigate, you know, the continuing bigotry that we see right now.
So if we're talking about those issues more than ever, you might look at a failed Trump candidacy as a positive?
I would definitely say it could be a positive. It could very well be a teaching moment.
Christopher Parker, political science professor, University of Washington. He mentioned Donald Trump's response to the transgender bathroom issue. Trump surprised pundits by saying transgender woman Caitlyn Jenner could use any bathroom she wants at Trump Tower in New York. He said this after the state of North Carolina passed a so-called bathroom bill, removing a protection for trans people who use the bathroom that's consistent with their gender identity. This debate is happening here in Washington State as well. KUOW's law and politics reporter Amy Radel says if a group of advocates gets enough signatures here, Washington could follow North Carolina.
Initiative 1515 would reverse a rule implemented last year under Washington State's anti-discrimination law. That rule says people should be allowed to use the restroom corresponding with their gender identity. Joseph Backholm chairs the ballot measure campaign. He says the goal is to return to the status quo in which people could use whatever bathroom they wanted, but remove the legal recourse against businesses that maintain single-sex facilities. He says the state's so-called open bathrooms policy went too far.
Is it gives me a legal right to be present in the women's locker room at the gym, and it gives me a right to sue the gym owner if he tries to stop me. Everyone would agree that it would be inappropriate for me to be there, so I should not have a legal right to be there by just speaking the words I'm identifying or I'm expressing as a woman today.
The ballot measure would also require sex-specific restrooms and locker rooms in public schools. Backholm says school officials would have to keep transgender students from mixing with other students.
No student would be forced to go into any room that they didn't want to go into any locker room. They just wouldn't be allowed into the facility of the opposite gender while there are other students there dressing or undressing.
He says that could mean having them use a single stall bathroom or faculty bathroom. The proposal says any student who encounters a person of the opposite sex in a restroom or locker room could sue the school. Backholm's group must submit 246,000 valid signatures by July 8th to qualify for the November ballot. Meanwhile, the group Washington Won't Discriminate is about to kick off a campaign to oppose the ballot measure. I'm Amy Radel, KUOW News.
And we will bring you a report on that group leading the charge against Initiative 1515 later today here on KUOW. And if you miss any of it, please get KUOW's podcasts. Our news reports, our Week in Review, Radioactive, Speakers Forum, Nancy Pearl, and this program, The Record, it's all available on your favorite podcast app. Or just go to KUOW.org. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. It's been more than 4 years since the U.S. military ended its ban on openly gay service members. Before that policy change, some 80,000 troops have been kicked out of the military since World War II, either because they were gay or they were suspected of being gay. Many of them are still denied veterans benefits. Reporter John Ismay has this part of our American Homefront project.
In September 2010, President Obama signed a bill ending discrimination of gay and lesbian troops.
We are a nation that welcomes the service of every patriot. We are a nation that believes that all men and women are created equal.
The new law was a major step forward for lesbian, gay, and bisexual service members. Until then, being gay often was cause for a less than honorable discharge. Under the policy known as Don't Ask, Don't Tell, gay people were allowed to serve but could still be kicked out if their sexual orientation was discovered. The bill President Obama signed changed that, but nothing changed for the tens of thousands of veterans kicked out under the old policies, like Veronica Fimbres.
I'm a veteran of the United States Navy, serving in Vietnam era.
Fimbres is transgender. She identifies as a woman. But at Camp Pendleton, Fimbres was living outwardly as a male and was sexually uncertain. She says she stood out and was constantly subjected to sexual harassment. And in 1974, Fimbres was kicked out of the Navy after being diagnosed by a Navy psychiatrist as a latent homosexual.
And I was discharged general under honorable conditions, although my work was exemplary and everything I did was honorable. I was given that because I was perceived to be homosexual.
That type of less than honorable discharge is usually reserved for misconduct, like testing positive for drugs or getting a DUI. Having it on your record can make it harder to get a job and can keep you from getting veterans' benefits.
It was very humiliating. It was very painful. They just treated us horrible.
Fimbres moved on to San Francisco, where she worked as a nurse and became the city's commissioner of veterans affairs. It was then she learned that the Defense Department was allowing veterans discharged for being gay to apply for status upgrades. What she didn't yet know is how hard the process would be. Peter Perkowski is an attorney with the nonprofit group OutServe. He helps veterans through the process of having their discharges upgraded.
After Donors Don't Tell was repealed, most people thought, you know, the issue was over. We could go home, but no.
Veterans with less than honorable discharges have to produce paperwork that might be decades old. They have to prove they were kicked out solely for being gay. The process can take years and is hard to get through without a lawyer. The Pentagon declined to comment about the process, but some want to change it, like Congressman and Korean War veteran Charlie Rangel. Rangel's introduced legislation that would require the Defense Department to automatically upgrade anyone kicked out for being gay to an honorable discharge.
If indeed the new laws as it exists today, the veteran would be entitled to an honorable discharge, then immediately, without any act on the part of the veteran, that discharge would be upgraded and the veteran will be so notified.
He says that's only fair.
It was the government that committed the act of processing the person out with a dishonorable discharge, and the least we can do is correct it.
The legislation was first introduced in 2013 and still hasn't gotten a vote. In the meantime, veterans like Veronica Fimbres are going it alone. She says she wants a memento of her time in the Navy that she can be proud of.
There's nothing like an honorable discharge. I would like one that's suitable for framing to put on my wall to show that I served my country honorably, which I did.
Fimbres filed her appeal a few months ago, but is yet to hear back. I'm John Ismay reporting.
Our stories on the military and veterans are part of the American Homefront Project, a national collaboration with NPR, KUOW, WUNC in Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina, and KPCC in Los Angeles. For 25 years, a Victorian house on 15th Avenue on Capitol Hill has been a kind of second home for LGBTQ youth. Today it's called the Lambert House, and it might not be in that location much longer. The owner of the house is putting it up for sale. Lambert House has until the end of the year to raise an estimated $2 million to buy the home. Alan Andrews Katz used its services when he was coming out in the 80s, and he says for many LGBTQ kids, it matters that Lambert House stays on Capitol Hill.
A lot of kids are coming from outside of Seattle. It's centrally located. There's buses that run by from every direction, so no matter what direction the kid's coming from, they can get there with relative ease. Also, the fact that it's been there for 25 years, it's recognizable, people know where it's at. It's also close to other things that service that particular community. I just think it's important that the kids are able to be around, one, something that's been so established, and two, other people who may not benefit from those services, like me as an adult, but are accepting of those kids.
What do kids find when they find Lambert House?
They offer a different group every night. So there's a men's group, a women's group, a trans group. There's just a general night for hanging out, puzzles, things like that. They offer meal services, or I think they do one meal a day. They offer clothes, toiletries to kids that are homeless. They offer referrals to shelters that accept gay and can deal with gay and lesbian youth, because not all of them do. They provide a lot of really good services. I mean, a lot of the kids are, you know, ostracized by their families or thrown out, and this is some place for them to go to get some help.
Why is this so important to you, Alan?
Because I was a gay kid growing up in a very conservative area.
You're from Port Gamble.
I'm from Port Gamble. I mean, it's not that far from Seattle, but as the crows flies, 25, 30 miles. But back in 1980, ideologically, it was worlds away. It was so conservative back there. There was no way I would have ever come out in high school.
Alan, will you tell me the story of how you found, it wasn't Lambert House at the time, it was the forerunner to what's now Lambert House on Capitol Hill.
Right. I would come over to Seattle with friends for dim sum. We loved to do that. And I noticed on one of our trips that at the bottom of the ferry terminal, there's the ramp that you leave the ferry terminal from down to Western Avenue. Right at the bottom was a row of newspaper boxes with alternative newspapers, including the Seattle Gay News. So at 15, 16 years old, I would come over with my friends to dim sum, and I would have to make some excuse to run back to the ferry terminal without my friends so I could reach into that box, pull out the Seattle Gay News, and put it into my bag before going to meet them. And that's how I ran across them. I mean, at the time, you couldn't Google them on the internet. It didn't exist. So my finding of them was basically looking through the newspaper, trying to see, you know, things like me. And I saw an ad for this particular organization and their youth group. They had just opened up. I mean, they've been in existence for 35 years. I think I started going to them within their first year of existence. So it was important to me to be able to come to some place where I was accepted and I looked like everybody else, or looked like, if you will.
What does that mean, look like?
I just feel being around people that are like you is going to do so much for these kids. I mean, I grew up with such a sense of shame over who I was until I found this group, until I finally accepted, until I made the decision that it's my life and I don't care what other people think. But at 14, you don't really have, most kids don't have the wherewithal to do that. And it can be very oppressive. I mean, the benefit we did a couple weeks ago, they brought in four kids to speak. Two of the four specifically mentioned if Lambert House were not there, they would have killed themselves by now. And it kind of frightens me that 50% of our youth is thinking along those lines. And Lambert House does something to help them at least find something to support them.
We're not talking about Lambert House disappearing. We're talking about it possibly leaving Capitol Hill.
Right.
What would be so bad about moving to a different place?
Well, it would depend on where the place is. I mean, first off, they're not going to be able to afford any place in Seattle as it is. I know the building that they're in right now, from what I understand, is the asking price is $2 million, which I think is going to be about what they're going to be asked for any property that's going to fit them and fit their needs. I mean, this building is ideally situated for them. It's an old Victorian building, lots of rooms. They can have more than one meeting. They can have different things going on at different times. They have private rooms for counseling sessions. I mean, it's a really great place.
What do you want to say to the owner who wants to sell Lambert House from Capitol Hill?
I would ask him to do everything he or she can to work with the existing group and help keep them in. If they can come up with a payment plan or if they can do something else to assist them in maintaining this vital service, I think it would be greatly appreciated and looked upon very favorably.
Alan, Seattle is changing. It's gayborhood is, Capitol Hill is becoming less so, and things move, and things move to the suburbs. And why shouldn't that just be allowed to happen as life moves on?
Capitol Hill is changing. It's not necessarily because people want to move out. I think a lot of it has been affected by what's going on in South Lake Union, and there's a lot of money that's moved up to Capitol Hill. A lot of people who wouldn't normally have lived there have now moved in, and it's drastically changing the area. I think it's actually more important to have a gay area. I mean, right now, we've seen an uptick in hate crimes that have gone on up there. We've had people that have been attacked on a more regular basis, violently. I prefer to stay there simply because I really benefited from the entire community as a young gay man growing up, or not growing up, but as a young gay man coming out. It was nice to be in an area that really the majority of the people there were people I could identify with.
Alan Andrews Katz. As a young gay man, he relied on services like those provided at the Lambert House, and now he's helping to raise money so the organization can stay where it is on Capitol Hill in Seattle. Lambert House has until the end of the year to raise an estimated $2 million. You're listening to KUOW's The Record. We're on Twitter at KUOW, Facebook, KUOW Public Radio, and I hope you'll get our podcast and carry us with you on your favorite podcast app or just go to KUOW.org.